Good evening to everyone. It is good to be back for our afternoon service, and we're certainly thankful and happy to see all that are able to be with us. As David said, and as you can see on the board, we'll be continuing our series in the parables this evening, and we'll be considering the parable of the talents, which is found in Matthew chapter 25. If you'd like to turn there, we'll be reading through it as we go through this evening, just a couple verses at a time. This is very similar to another parable of Jesus that is found in Luke chapter 19. There you will find a parable known sometimes as the parable of the minas, and it's very, very similar. It talks about three servants given a sum of money and the way that they used it, and two used it faithfully and one did not. And there are a lot of similarities, but there are also some clear differences between those two parables. Some commentators think they're different takes on the same parable. I think that they are two different parables. Jesus taught very similar lessons in them, but I do think that they are distinct parables. And for our purposes tonight, we are simply going to study the parable of the talents that is found in Matthew chapter 25. Now, when we talk about the parable of the talents, I think it's important to consider the context. In fact, you've heard me say many times that when we study a passage, we need to know the context, and we need to kind of look at what's before it and what's after it, and we need to know the context of the passage that we're looking at. And studying this passage, I found that I really hadn't looked at the context as much as I should have in this parable before. I've used this parable, I've referenced this parable many times, and it's an easy parable to use on its own. It's a parable that we hear taught from sermons or referenced in sermons fairly frequently, but it is a part of a larger discourse. It's not just a standalone parable. It is, in fact, part of a discourse, and it's towards the end of a discourse that really takes up two entire chapters in the book of Matthew. In Matthew chapters 24 and 25, we have what is often called the Olivet Discourse. This is a discussion, not so much a discussion, it's primarily a sermon, but it's a sermon that Jesus gives privately to the disciples. It appears that they are by themselves with him when they have withdrawn. They ask Jesus a question, and that question results in Matthew chapter 24 and chapter 25. In verse 3, in Matthew 24 and 3, we see the question. It says, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming of the end of the age? Now, if you look there, if you look at the couple of verses just before that in 22, there is Jesus foretells the destruction of the temple. He says, truly, there will not be left one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And so he's talking about the temple. He speaks of the destruction of Jerusalem. And sometime later, the disciples come to him privately, and they say, Lord, when is this going to happen? This is some fairly disturbing news for Jesus to talk about the temple literally being torn down, Jerusalem undergoing some type of great disaster. And they say, when is this going to happen? And what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? Now, it seems that the disciples may have pictured this event as one event, the event in which the temple would be destroyed and maybe Jerusalem suffered would be the event in which Jesus would return, and that would be the end of the age. Well, Jesus answers their question, and he does so in two parts because there are two answers to the question. First of all, he discusses the destruction of Jerusalem. There's a lot of controversy about Matthew chapters 24 and 25, and if you were to read various commentators and scholars, you would find different interpretations. But a lot of what you see today in people trying to predict the end of time and talk about the signs of the end of the times, there's a lot in Revelation that they use or misuse, but a lot of it also comes from Matthew chapter 24. And they think that there are signs of the end of the times that we can discern to help us know when the end is coming. But it's important to realize that in Matthew 24, verses 4 through 35, Jesus is speaking about the destruction of Jerusalem. And that's not the topic, so we're not going to talk about that tonight. But that's what Jesus is speaking of in those verses. But then in verse 36, he shifts and he begins to talk about the end of time, the end of the age, the return of the Son of Man. And these are two different events. Now, the disciples very likely, it seems from their question anyways, thought that maybe this would be one and the same event. And Jesus is showing these are not one and the same event. In fact, they are two completely separate events. That can be seen by the fact that Jesus tells them there would be signs. In that passage about the destruction of Jerusalem, he gives them signs that would be able to be noticed. People that would have paid attention to Jesus' words and listened to him, faithful Christians that listened to those words, would have been able and were able, by the way, to see Jesus' prophecy being fulfilled, and they were able to escape Jerusalem before it was completely destroyed by the Romans in A.D. 70. But in verse 36, clearly Jesus changes because he says, "But concerning that day," that day refers to the final day, the day of judgment, which that's different. As he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, he talks about the days in those days. But he now shifts to that day and hour. He says, "No one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only." And so Jesus says, the destruction of Jerusalem, here are the signs that you can know and see that it is coming. But as far as the day of judgment, no one knows. It is not something that you can predict. It is not something that will be accompanied by signs. It's not something that we can look to the stars and the moon or the wars or the news and say, "All right, folks, the return of the Lord has got to be within a couple of days because here are the signs." Jesus says there will be no signs. You won't know. And that's why, by the way, up to this point in time, every single prophecy about the world ending has proven to be a false prophecy. Every time people say, "Well, the world's going to end on May 10th of this year," May 10th comes and goes. And we've seen that through our lifetime over the last several years. And Jesus said, no one knows the day or the hour. Now, as he talks about that, he shifts focus from the fact that, you know, that's pretty easy to say. No one knows the time or the hour. Now Jesus is going to spend the rest of this Olivet Discourse talking about what we do about that. Essentially, that we must be prepared. And since there will be no signs of the Lord's return, he reminds his disciples and us that there is a need to always be prepared for the Master's return. And he does so through the use of several parables. In fact, before we get to the parable of the talent, there are three, one of them very, very short, but there are essentially three parables concerning the end. In Matthew 24, verse 30, 43 and 44, this is a very brief parable. It's almost hard to even call a parable, but in a way it is. He refers to his return as the coming of a thief. And the point of that is not that Jesus is coming to steal something or that he is coming to do something wrong, but as a thief is unexpected, so the Lord's return will be unexpected. Again, destruction of Jerusalem, you will see signs, you will be able to get out. The coming of the Son of Man, there will be no signs. No, thieves don't leave evidence that they're getting ready to come. Thieves don't let you know, approximately in this time frame, somewhere between here and here, I could come. They come unexpectedly. And Jesus says, that is how the return of the Son of Man will be. Moving on from there, he gives the parable of the unfaithful servant. This is a parable of, Jesus uses master-servant imagery, which is what he'll use in the parable of the talents. And he tells the story of a master who goes off to another place. And while he's gone, the servant, who was maybe the chief steward, he begins to act wickedly. And he believes that his master is going to be a long time before he comes back. And he begins to act wickedly and to abuse the servants and to not give them the things that they need. And then the master returns before he is prepared. Now, it seems this man thought, well, I will get things in line. I'll get everything up to shape and up to code before the master gets back. But I've got plenty of time. And he's surprised when the master comes back early. The warning there is Jesus could come before you're ready. Jesus could come before you expect it. But then he turns around in Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13, and he gives the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. And the point of this is almost the exact opposite. If you remember in that story, there were 10 virgins. Five of them brought enough oil. Five of them didn't. And there the Lord is likened to the bridegroom, but it says that he delayed in his coming. Instead of coming too early, he takes longer than expected to return. And some of them were not prepared for the lengthy wait. They began and they were in earnest at the beginning, but when things took longer and longer and longer, they weren't prepared. And so they ultimately got caught unprepared because they hadn't planned. And so Jesus uses these parables not to contradict, but to show and to emphasize the fact we don't know when the end is coming. The end could be very close. This could be the last day this world ever knows. This world could go on for another 100 or another 1,000 or another 1,000,000 years. We don't know, and we don't have to know. However long this world lasts, our death could be quite imminent, or we could be granted decades yet to come. So if that's the case, then what do we do? Well, the points of the parables of the unfaithful servant and the wise and foolish virgins have already somewhat indicated it, but that's what the next parable is about. Since we don't know when the master is returning, our responsibility is simply to be faithful until he does. To be good stewards, to be working, and to be faithful servants until he comes. Whether that be in a very short time, or whether that be a very, very long time from now. So with that, let's dive into our parable. We'll read verses 14 and 15. It says, "Therefore, it will be like a man going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted to them property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away." In this parable, Jesus goes back to this imagery of master and servants. This master has to go away for a while. He has a journey to some other place. And while he's going to depart, he does not want his possessions to lie dormant. This is a very, very wealthy master, as we see throughout the remainder of the parable. And he could just leave his possessions lie. He could have them do nothing. But that doesn't make a very good use of the possessions, does it? And so instead of doing that, he determines to divvy out a portion of his wealth to some of his servants so that they can use it while he's gone, so that they can put it to work and gain more. He is entrusting this with the servants. And it's important to see right off the bat that this money, these talents, are the master's. The servants are not owners of the money. And even though they were given huge sums of money, we'll talk about what the talent was worth in just a moment, it wasn't theirs. They had a responsibility to care for it, to put it to work, to earn more from it, but it wasn't their talents. It was the master's talent. They were simply stewards. And we must remember, all that we have, everything that we are given, is given to us by God. James tells us that every good and perfect gift is from God above. And it is so easy for us to forget that. We think that, well, it's my money. It's my time. It's my life. It's my desires. It's my this, my that. No, it's not. Everything we have is given by God. The reason that I have breath in my lungs is by the grace of God. The abilities that I have, can I work to increase them? Sure. But the only reason I have the ability to work to increase them is, again, by the grace of God. The things that I have are God's. My very life belongs to God. As Ecclesiastes tells us, the whole purpose of man is to fear God and to keep his commandments. And yet we live so often as though everything we have is ours. Our time, our desires, our homes, our money, our riches. We don't realize that we are just stewards. Stewards with great gifts, steward with great responsibility, but we must remember that we are stewards, and we must use all that we can and all that we are entrusted with for the purpose of God's glory. In every realm of life, we are stewards. Now, the master divides these talents among the servants as he sees fit. It says that he gives them each according to his ability. He gives to one 5 talents, he gives to one 2 talents, and he gives to one talent. Now, this is not unfair. Now, this is one difference in the parable of the minas. In the parable of the minas, each servant was given the exact same. They were all given one. But in this parable, the master surveys his men, and he chooses, this man I can trust with 5 talents. This man I can trust with 2 talents. This man I can trust with 1 talent. That's not unfair. That's not favoritism. It's not being too harsh on the man with 1 talent. It's wisdom. You know, employers don't just give every single employee the exact same responsibility, do they? Why? Because people are at different levels. People have different abilities. People have different interests. And so responsibility is usually given out as one can handle it. You give someone too much responsibility and you set them up for failure. You give another person not enough responsibility and you set them up for other types of failure. And at the end of the day, remember, these talents are the master's talents. If he wants to give 5 to 1 and 2 to another and 1 to another, that's his prerogative. He is the owner of these talents. Now, as far as an application from this, I think we can recognize that all of us as individuals vary in our abilities. We vary in our strengths. We vary in our opportunities. This makes a nice play on words in the English language. We vary in our talents. In this setting, the word talent is referring to a sum of money. We refer to a talent similarly to abilities. But what we need to always remember is it's not about how much we're given. You know, some people look at someone and they say, oh, well, that's a five-talent Christian. That's someone who can do all sorts of things. He can preach, he can sing, he can pray, he can study, he can do all these things. I can't do all those things. I'm just a one-talent, if even that. That's not the point. The point is that we are to use whatever it is that God gives us. In Romans chapter 12, verses 5 through 8, Paul said, though we, though many, are one body in Christ and individually members of one another, and having gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, in proportion to our faith. If service, in our serving. If one, the one who teaches, in his teaching. The one who exhorts, in his exhortation. The one who contributes, generosity. The one who leads, with zeal. The one who does acts of mercy, with cheerfulness. You get the picture. We all have different abilities. We have different strengths. We're at different levels of maturity in our Christian walk. That's not a reason for us to ever look up to others and say, well, they should do all the work, or I can never be that. And it's never a reason for us to look down on others and say, well, I'm more talented than that individual. I deserve more. I'm better. I work more. That's not the attitude. We just need to have an honest accounting of ourselves and be honest with, what has God given me? What has God enabled me with? What opportunities has God given unto me? And am I using them? Am I using them to the fullness of my ability? And am I using them to the glory of God? We must each use the ability and the opportunity we have. And as we do, we'll grow. The five-talent servant became a 10-talent servant. The two-talent servant became a 4-talent servant. The one-talent servant could have easily have increased his holdings had he just done some work with it. But further, and I think this is an important point, we sometimes look and say, oh, one talent compared to five talents. You know, that man had five times as much as the one talent man. But the thing about this parable is every one of these amounts is great. One talent, and this is somewhat ambiguous, but most commentators will say that one talent basically equated to 20 years labor. For your average laborer, what we might think of as minimum wage, probably a little bit more than minimum wage, a talent was what one might expect to earn in a lifetime. Back in a day when you probably only worked about 20 years of your life, life expectancies being shorter, ability to work longer, this was 20 years worth of work. Now, if you even just take the minimum wage today in America and you multiply, you assume full-time work for 20 years, that's over $300,000. If you take more of an average wage, it would be much higher than that. And so this one-talent man wasn't given piddly scraps and the five-talent man given extravagance. The one-talent man was given a great responsibility. Can you imagine being given $300,000 to $500,000 and saying, go use this? You could do something with that. He wasn't given a dollar and expected to go do something. He was given a great sum. And you see, the point there is that the gifts that God gives us are always great. Sometimes we look at others and we think, I wish I had that talent. I wish I had that ability. I can't be as fruitful in God's kingdom because I can't do this. I can't act this way. I can't influence the way so-and-so does. Yes, you can. Whatever talents we are given, they are given by God. Whatever abilities, whatever opportunities, even opportunities are gifts. And all of them can be used for God. But the question is, am I using the gifts that God has given me? Do I use what ability and opportunity I have to serve God, or do I simply make excuses for not serving God? Well, continuing on in verses 16 through 18, it says, he who had received the five talents went at once and traded with them, and he made five talents more. So also he who had two talents made two talents more, but he who had received the one talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. So we see what the servants do with this money. First of all, the servant with five talents wasted no time. We're told that he went at once. He went immediately and began working with the treasure that had been entrusted to him. Now, We don't know if they knew how long the master was going to be gone. We're told later that he was gone for a long time. It would have been very easy for this servant and the other servants to say, we've just been given this. It's going to take the master a while to get where he's going. He's got a lot of business while he's there, and then it'll take him a long time to get back. Why don't we wait till tomorrow? We could put this off till next week. We could probably put this off till next month. But this servant shows a portion of his faithfulness because he gets to work immediately. Likewise, we should never delay in our own service to the Lord. There is absolutely no wisdom and there is no benefit in waiting for a better time to work for the Lord. Don't wait until things get straightened out at work. Don't wait until you've got your education under the belt. Don't wait until the kids are a little bit older or maybe even out of the house. Don't wait until a more convenient season. Work and serve the Lord now. Obey him now. Obey the gospel now. Serve him now. Labor in his kingdom now. Do so immediately. Because if we don't, we may end up like the unfaithful servant in the prior parable. The one who was always planning, fully intending to get things ready before the master came back, and yet he was found unprepared. But also, notice that the faithful servants did something. They worked. We're not told the details of their trading and how arduous it was or how much it required of them, but they went to work. They put the money to work. They put the talents to work. And the truth is, in the kingdom of God, there is work to do. It's interesting how many of Jesus' parables are master-servant parables. What do servants do? They work. They have a job to do. We have a job to do. There are things that we should be doing to worship God, to serve his kingdom. And we need to be busy with the master's work. On the other hand, the servant entrusted with just the one talent did not labor. Instead, we're told that the majority of his labor was digging a hole and hiding the talent. Now, this was actually, and I learned this in reading, this was in some ways a common practice. This was, you know, they didn't have electronic banking like we do. They didn't have government insurance for banking deposits like we do. And so one of the ways that some people would protect treasure was they would bury it. Remember, Jesus talked about finding a treasure buried or hidden in the field. Why do you think it was buried there in the first place? Because someone had put it there, meaning to hide it. Now, you wanted to mark it, you wanted to know where it was, but this was a way to keep thieves from hopefully finding it, keeping yourself from losing it. It was a manner of safeguarding what you had. And so this man safeguards what he has. And at first we might think, well, at least he didn't steal or squander the talent. At least he didn't go out and just use it for riotous living. At least he didn't go out and gamble it away. At least he didn't go out and make stupid decisions with it. He kept it safe. But let's remember, the master had not entrusted the talent to this man or the other servants to keep them safe. If that was the master's goal and desire, he could have simply taken the talents with him, and they would have been just as safe. His desire was for the servants to put the talents to work. He wanted them to use them and to earn more. The gifts of the gospel and the gifts of salvation are not something to be safeguarded and hidden. Jesus reminds us in Matthew 5 that we are the light of the world and our light should not be hidden. We don't hide it and put it under a basket, but we let our light shine. We use our abilities. We use the gifts of God. We use the gift of the gospel to share the gospel and to influence others. Now, this parable should clearly show us that Christ is not pleased with Christians who do nothing but sit and observe. Now, what we do and how we do it and what we can do may vary greatly, but we should be working. If our Christianity is simply a passive thing that never requires any work, never requires any action, any service or any sacrifice, then truth be told, we are more like the wicked servant in this parable. Now, what else in this life is worth our greatest attention and effort? What other endeavor is worth working for? Well, you know, I wonder, what did this servant do the entire time the master was gone? He wasn't using the talent. So what was he doing? Perhaps he was enjoying his life. Perhaps he was pursuing other dreams, other opportunities. We don't know what he was doing. But he wasn't working for the master. Similarly, some people today are very, very busy. It's not that they're lazy outright. It's that they're lazy when it comes to serving God, because they'd rather go work at a career and make money for themselves than work for the Lord. Because they'd rather entertain themselves and enjoy recreation and all of life's niceties and pleasures than give up certain things or make sacrifices and serve the Lord. How pathetic we are if we simply bury the Lord's talent only to spend our time and our energies and our opportunities that God has given to us on our desires and our goals while letting the kingdom suffer from our lack of work. How dare we neglect the work of the Lord so that we can work for other men and ourselves more than God? Now, perhaps we think much like this man. Perhaps we think as long as we don't lose what we have, as long as we don't fall away from the church, we'll be okay. Sure, we're not producing fruit, nor are we even trying to produce fruit, but hey, at least we're here, right? At least we show up now and then. At least we haven't lost what the Master gave us. Just remember, that was the attitude of the man that had been given one servant. And I'm sure you know the end of the story. It doesn't end well for the man who just does nothing but not lose what the Master gives him. Well, we find the settling of accounts in the next few verses. Beginning in verse 19, it says, "After a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, 'Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.' And he also who had 2 talents came forward saying, 'Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more.' His master said to him, 'Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master.'" So we're told that it was a long time. But when he does, he calls his servants to him, the servants with which he has entrusted his own wealth in order to settle accounts with them. Now one day, every single person, every single soul in this room will step before Jesus for the intent purpose of settling accounts. We will be required to give an account for how we lived our lives, how we used the gifts, the talents, the abilities, the opportunities that God has blessed us with. Paul reminds the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 5 and 10, "We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." There is coming a day when we will have to settle accounts with the Lord. Now, the settling of the accounts for the first 2 servants is identical. Notice something important. Both of them, even though they had earned, they had doubled the money, they had done a great job, they begin by recognizing why they were able to in the first place. They both say, "Master, you delivered unto me 5 talents or 2 talents. Now, some people in this situation would begin by saying, "I made 5 talents. Look at what I've done." They begin by acknowledging they could have done nothing had the master not given them the talents in the first place. Do you think either of them would have produced 5 talents or 2 talents had the master not given them the ability, the talents in the first place? Well, of course not. And likewise, we need to be careful as we grow, as we mature, as we work for God. We should never boast in our successes. We should never become arrogant or proud of what we accomplish. We should remember that all we accomplish is done by the grace of God. All our strength and all our ability is only because God has granted it. And it should be done not for our glory, but for the glory of the Father. And then, in both cases, the master does essentially 3 things. First of all, he commends the servants. He says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Now, here's something important. He says, "good and faithful." That faithful is the key word in this sentence, and it's the key word of this entire parable, I believe. These men had been entrusted with a portion of the master's wealth in order to put it to work and produce more. The first 2 servants, they had faithfully discharged their duty. They diligently worked with what they had been given, and thus they were deemed as fruitful. They were deemed as good also. Because they were faithful, they were good. Today, we need to realize our actions reveal our real character. We may wish to be good, We may think ourselves good, but if we are not working for the master, if we are not diligent and faithful, then can we rightly appraise our character as good? But the master does not just commend his servants. He honors them and elevates them with even greater responsibility. Now, this is not the menial punishing of the faithful with more work. Some people are nervous at their jobs to do too good of a job because they know they'll just get more thrown on them. They'll just have more dumped in their lap and not in an appreciative way. But in a good way, in a wholesome way, when people prove themselves faithful and responsible, it is not a burden to give them more responsibility. It is an honor. It is a privilege to have such responsibility. And this master, he could have said, wonderful work. Glad you did it. Give me the 10 talents. Maybe here's a small portion for your labor. And that would have been his prerogative to do so. But instead, he works with them even further. And he says, that's a wonderful job. And now that you've been faithful over a little, shows us his wealth. This was just a little for the master. He says, you've proven your faithfulness in a little matter. I can now trust you with even greater things. And he's going to reward these men with greater opportunity to serve him. And then, of course, he also gives them a reward. He says, enter into the joy of your master. The servants had been entrusted with the master's possessions, and having proven themselves faithful, now they would also get to share with the master's joy. But then we read of the slothful servant in verses 24 through 27. It says, he also who had received the one talent came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. But his master answered him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scatter no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. These words of the last servant pose perhaps one of the biggest challenges of this parable. Because we look at this parable and I think that we rightly associate the master with the Lord. But when you read of this man's description, it doesn't seem very Lord-like. It doesn't seem much like Jesus. As he says, you're a hard man. In fact, you reap where you didn't sow. You take basically what isn't yours. You're a frightening individual. And we think, well, that doesn't sound like a very good master. And the key here is, that's not an accurate description. That's not an accurate description of who the master is. In fact, the master has already shown in his generosity, in his willingness to reward when he didn't have to. He has shown himself to be a good master, a loving master, a kind master, to offer these men to enter into his joy, to entrust them with even greater riches than he had in the first place. He was a good man, not a hard, cheating, greedy master. What this is, it's simply an excuse. Maybe the man had told it to himself so many times that he actually believed it. But like most excuses, it was based on pretense and even falsehood. The master was not a cruel and a greedy man. And the fact that this is an excuse and not the reality works against this man. Because let's say, and this is what gets him, this is how the master responds. Basically, he says, okay, if you knew me to be a hard man, a greedy man, a man that wanted more than I even had right to claim, then what made you think that going and hiding my talent was a good idea? Surely you knew that if I was a harsh master, I'd want something when I came back. The least you could have done is gone and given it to the bankers, and at least I would have had it with some interest. No, the key here is not that the master was cruel and harsh. This is what the servant said to try and get himself off the hook. Instead of copping up to his own laziness, he essentially blames the master and the fear that was supposedly instilled in him. Now, we aren't told much about the motives, but the condemnation that is given, I think, speaks volume. He says, you wicked and slothful servant. Why did this man go and hide his talent in the ground? Was it because he was afraid of losing the talent? I don't think so. It was because he was simply slothful. He was lazy. He didn't want to put the work in for whatever reason, for whatever things he had that he thought were better than serving his master in this opportunity that he'd been given. We don't know, but he simply didn't want to work. He was slothful and he was lazy, and thus he made excuse for his behavior. And we need to take note, first of all, of the grave and serious nature of laziness. Again, I don't think most people are lazy. There are a lot of lazy people, but most people I know in the church, I don't think are lazy people. They're very busy people. They're active people. They're hard workers, and that's all good. But I do fear that sometimes, while we may work very, very hard at school, at work, and in every other realm of life, that sometimes we are lazy spiritually. Sometimes we don't put in the work and the effort to grow our knowledge, to speak to God, to serve others, to help the services of the church, to do everything that we can for the glory of God's kingdom. Sometimes it's just a little bit easier to hide that talent and work on everything else. But also we need to beware of excuses and realize that excuses have no part in the Christian's life. At the end of the day, either we are seeking to follow God or we're not. Making excuses won't change anything. Jesus warned against making excuses in Luke chapter 14. If you remember a different parable there where he talked about a man throwing a banquet and the people went out to share the news. And one man said, well, I've bought some oxen and I need to go test them. And another man said, well, I bought a piece of land and I need to go inspect it. My favorite of all those, another man just said, well, I've married a wife and I can't come. And I don't know if that was an excuse or just a statement of fact, but that's all he said. But Jesus said they made excuse. Guess what? None of them came to the banquet. What's the lesson there? Excuses are not going to get you into heaven. They will almost surely keep you out of it. One of the things, and this is a little bit of a soapbox, I admit, but it drives me crazy when I hear people say, well, the Lord understands my situation. Well, the Lord knows why I can't come to church services. Well, the Lord knows why I can't do this. The Lord knows why I won't do that. The Lord knows why I worship in error. The Lord knows my heart. Yes, he does. He certainly does. And he knows when it's not obedient and humble before him. That's true for me, and it's true for all of us. And the Lord does know your situation. And the Lord knows the situation of the people that have made sacrifices in order to serve him. And he knows when we're just making excuses to try and justify ourselves. Excuses have never justified themselves, justified people before God. And they won't justify us either. And thus, while the good two first servants are noted as good and faithful, these are wicked and slothful. It is important that we are diligent, that we are faithful. That's what leads to goodness. Now, like I said, sometimes we think, well, as long as I don't lose what I have, right? The problem is that slothfulness never leads to goodness. Slothfulness ultimately leads to wickedness. So again, I ask, how hard are we working? How hard am I working spiritually? I'm not talking about trying to earn and merit salvation, but I'm talking about doing what the Lord has called us to do, to work for him in his kingdom. Are we busy serving God in the ways that we can? Are we growing in our faith? Or are we slothful and lazy when it comes to spiritual matters? Well, the sentence that is handed down, the master says, so take the talent from him and give it to him who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given to him, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The final servant was given the same opportunity as the others to serve his master. He wasn't punished because he didn't double his reward. He wasn't punished because he hadn't produced 4 talents or 10 talents. He was punished because he was slothful and he had done nothing. But further, his opportunity was taken away. He had opportunity to serve the master. But after he had proven himself unfaithful, his opportunity was gone. There will come a point. Right now you have opportunity. I have opportunity right now to serve the Lord. But there is coming a point when we will have no more opportunity. We may plan all we want to grow in our knowledge of God's word. We may plan all we want to be better at praying. We may plan all we want to worship more. We may plan all we want to serve more, to visit more, to do more of everything. But the opportunity to do those things is now. And there's coming a day when we will run out of those opportunities. And if we have not tried, if we have not made any effort, then our opportunity will simply be taken. The master commands the talent to be taken and given to the servant who had 10 talents. Again, sometimes we might even think, well, this is unfair. It's the master's talents. But also, this is a natural principle. When Jesus says, for to everyone who has more will be given, and he will have an abundance, the one who has not even what he has will be taken away. Well, we can understand that in natural principles. For instance, think of your muscles. Now, if you use your muscles, if you exercise your muscles, what happens? The strength that you have grows. If you go into a gymnasium and you begin lifting weights, you may not be able to lift very much. I wouldn't be able to if I walked in right now. But if you're a normal individual in decent health and you can go in and start, what happens as you use them? They grow. They strengthen. What do you end up being able to do? You end up being able to lift more, to do more. You have greater endurance. What happens when you sit and don't use your muscles? They don't grow stronger. They grow weaker. They grow weaker. They grow weaker. In fact, if you literally sit and do nothing, your muscles will atrophy. It will get to a point where almost all your strength is lost. Well, the same is true with faith. If we use our faith, if we exercise our faith according to godliness, it can grow. Our perseverance can grow. Our godliness can grow. But if we don't exercise our faith, if we just show up from time to time and put in our hour or 2 hours at church and call it good, our faith will shrivel. Our spirituality will weaken until really there will be no real faith left. And then all we'll have at that point is excuses. And because this wicked servant is wicked and slothful, notice Jesus says he is worthless. That's harsh language. That's very harsh language. How would you like to be called worthless? Wouldn't like it. Jesus says the slothful servant is a worthless servant. That's not meant to be mean. That's meant to wake us up. We are supposed to be working for the master. And when we're not interested in that, we are worthless in his kingdom. What happens with worthless servants? Instead of entering into the joy of the master, they are cast into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The parable takes a very obvious spiritual turn here. Jesus isn't talking about a servant just getting fired and now he's free to go do what he wants. This is punishment. Not only does he not become honored, not only is he not rewarded, he is cast out from any more opportunity. He is punished in the everlasting hell where all his lot will be is weeping and gnashing of teeth. Well, just a couple of very quick summary points, and our time has fled away, but just a few things to take from this parable. This is a parable of faithfulness and stewardship. Remember today that everything you have, everything I have, is given by God, and we are merely stewards. Even our life belongs to him. And one day, as stewards, we will give account for how we have used his blessings. But also, remember this, God has given us great things. The final servant's downfall was not that he was a one-talent man. In fact, I tried through this sermon to not talk about the five-talent man and the one-talent man because that wasn't the problem and that wasn't the blessing. It wasn't that the one-talent man was worse because he was a one-talent man. He would have enjoyed the exact same reward had he worked. His problem was that he was slothful. But his one talent was a great gift. And we need to recognize all of our gifts from God are great, not because they are ours, but because they're God's. You might think that what you can do for the kingdom is minimal. But when it's done for the glory of God and with God's blessing, it can be a great help. Remember this morning, if you were here, we talked about, for example, the prayers of godly mothers. The women in this congregation, as long as we're faithful to the word of God, will never stand up here and powerfully proclaim the gospel in a public setting. That doesn't mean they haven't been given opportunity to serve God's kingdom. In fact, the talents that they're given and the faithfulness they use may serve this congregation much more powerfully than my preaching or any other man's preaching may be able to do. We don't know. We simply use the talents and the opportunities that God gives us and recognize that by his power, great things can happen. The other thing is, it's not about how much is given, but what we do with what we're given. Don't make excuses because you think that you're not talented enough. We can all be used in God's kingdom. And to do nothing because we feel we aren't talented enough is just making an excuse, just as the wicked and lazy servant was. And of course, in the context of the whole sermon that Jesus is giving, the point is this: we do not know when the Lord is going to return. We just don't. What we do know is that when he returns, and he is returning, we will have to settle accounts with him. And so what we must do is use the time that we have. We must be faithful and diligent in working for our master while we can. As we conclude, to say that it is by the love and the grace of God that Jesus came and died for our sins, and we are so thankful for that. He established because of this an everlasting kingdom, the kingdom that was promised in the Old Testament scriptures, but he has returned to his Father. Jesus, like the master in the parable, has taken a trip, and at this point he has been gone, in our estimation of time, a very long time. But he has given us what we need. He has entrusted us with his gospel. He has entrusted us with faithfulness. He has entrusted us with the message that can save men's souls. And one day he's coming back, and we will give an account to him. At that point, time will end. Earth will be no more. We will stand before the judge, and we will give an account of how we have used the gifts and the time that he has given to us. As I think about this parable, and I think about eternity, I think how wonderful it must be, how wonderful it will be to hear Jesus say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master." We all like compliments. We all like commendation. We all like rewards. If you work and you have a boss, I'm sure that you enjoy it when they say, "Job well done." I'm sure you enjoy it when they say, "You've done a great job. Here's a raise." That will be nothing in comparison to standing before the Lord and hearing him say, "Good, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master." But if we're not working and if we're not laboring, we will hear those terrible words, "You wicked and slothful servant, be cast out into outer darkness." Why spend another moment in the risk of spending eternity in the place where your lot will be nothing but the weeping and gnashing of teeth? Begin like the good and faithful servants to work immediately. If you have not obeyed the gospel tonight, obey the gospel today. If you've obeyed the gospel but you've returned to the ways of the world, return to faithful service today. The master is still away as of this moment, and thus you still have opportunity. Use it. Begin working. Begin serving. Begin living for him now, so that when he comes, you'll be prepared, because he could come tonight. Maybe he won't come till tomorrow. Maybe he won't come for another 1,000 years. But he might require your soul of you tonight. You don't know. So be prepared. And even if he doesn't come for another 100 years, even if you live decades, why not serve him faithfully for those decades? Why not begin now using the talents and abilities he's given you so that you can serve him and glorify him and show yourself to be a diligent and a faithful servant, so that one day you will be entered into the rest of your master also? Well, if there's one here who needs to obey the gospel, or one here who'd like the prayers of the church, then the invitation is open for you at this time, and we'd invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.